This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, The Age of Nature. It's a new PBS series that premieres tomorrow on Prairie Public. And we visit with a filmmaker exploring the world to find innovative ways people are restoring our planet. But first, we revisit the founding of this country, these United States. The Virginia Dynasty, four presidents, and the creation of the American nation is the latest book from historian Dr. Lynn Cheney. It focuses on four of our first five presidents, all of whom lived within a 60-mile radius of the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. Dr. Cheney is the author or co-author of 12 books on history. She has a Master of Arts degree from the University of Colorado at Boulder and a PhD in 19th century British literature. She is a former chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, a position she held from 1986 to 1993. She visited with presidential historian and former instructor at the University of Mary in Bismarck, Rick Collin.
Welcome to the program, Dr. Cheney.
Well, thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Well, I'm excited about visiting with you about your new book. It's a remarkable read. And before we get started talking about your book, though, I just wanted to touch base a little bit about these books that you wrote about American history for children. Tell us just a little bit about them and why you decided to write those books.
Well, at the time I began, I was actually writing a book on education policy. And then Dick was announced as vice president, and I could hardly write a book on, you know, the president's, President Bush's main initiative. So I decided that children's books would keep me out of trouble. And I also thought that children were a very important audience. And I have to tell you, I enjoyed writing those books so much. And I've been thinking I should go back to doing it at least one more time. Well, writing is always hard work. But, you know, kids loved them and their parents loved them. And that was so rewarding.
So what areas of American history did you cover in those children's books?
Well, one, the first one was called America, A Patriotic Primer. And this came out right after 9/11. And there was one page that actually made me cry. It was a page that quoted from a song we all know, and it said, "Thy alabaster cities gleam, undimmed by human tears." And gosh, it was so so timely to something that was so traumatic and moving. Mm-hmm. I then wrote one called A is for Abigail, about amazing American women. I'm not forgetting anything here. I wrote one about the Constitution that I enjoyed doing very much. I wrote one about Washington crossing the Delaware, which is an amazing story because it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's, you know, very upbeat and triumphant. And then I also wrote a book about the USA. It was sort of a travelogue of what you could see in various states, from, you know, the Tetons in Wyoming to the Great Peachoid. Do you know what that is? In Georgia.
Okay.
It's a giant peach high up in the air. So, you know, that was a lot of fun.
Good, good. Well, this is a good segue into your new book. Publishers Weekly says this about your book. Historian Cheney delivers an accessible group portrait of Washington, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. Charting the dynasty's evolving dynamics, Cheney sketches the Revolutionary War careers of Washington and Monroe, details internal disagreements over the Constitution, federalism, and foreign policy, and describes group efforts to clear the way for the next Virginian in line to the presidency. Cheney selects anecdotes wisely and writes gracefully. The result is an informative introduction to four of America's most important founding fathers. So where did you get your idea for a book like this, and how'd you go about getting your arm around such a huge topic?
It is huge. I was driven toward it, though, when I wrote my book on Madison, because it quickly became clear how intertwined his life, his ideas, and his achievements were with his three Virginia neighbors. Organizationally, it was hard to do, but I decided to stick with chronology and to weave around the chronology of the time. The most important events, of course, but also the most important interchanges, quarrels, contacts between the four men.
So give us just a little background of Virginia at this period in our nation's early history. It was the largest of the original 13 colonies.
Yes, and powerful within the colonies for that reason. But it was really a backwater as people on the other side of the Atlantic looked at it, particularly the British. It was not a place where you might have expected genius to erupt in the way that it did, unless you thought about, one, the educational system. In Virginia, the education for sons of the elite was very good, and Washington taught himself. But the other three went to great schools where they studied the Scottish Enlightenment, which is a particular way of looking at the Enlightenment that sees human improvement as possible through reason and understanding. So that was very important, the fact that that they had this high education in common. They also benefited, of course, from being from the largest state and from having that kind of power, and from a custom in Virginia of having young men of the gentry class serve in public office at very young ages. So they were fully prepared, though they didn't know for what, until the Revolution began to build. And they found themselves in a place with the ideas that would help them build a new nation. And that was an amazing thing. It must have been thrilling to be in that place in that time and have an opportunity to put these ideas into effect.
So what were some of the shared philosophies those four men had that helped guide them in establishing our country all those years ago?
They were Enlightenment ideas. The time that they lived had such an influence on them, partly because it gave them an opportunity to do things that are unimaginable to most people. And so those ideas were a dependence that one should depend on reason rather than dogma. And you can certainly see this from Madison's early life on, where he absolutely condemned the intolerance in Virginia, which was mostly directed against Baptists. Jefferson, too, and they worked together on this, was an advocate of free speech, yes, but it was more than that. It was intellectual freedom that they worked on. So those were Enlightenment ideas, that you should use reason rather than follow dogma. It was also true that the Enlightenment envisioned a better future, one that reason would help reveal, and that would be based on inherent ideas like liberty, justice, equality. So certainly those were some ideas they had in common.
And of course, those were ideas that formed the basis for our Constitution and the Declaration of Independence before that.
Exactly. And they received praise from people generations down the line for enshrining these valuable ideas in our founding documents. Frederick Douglass said, you know, the Constitution was no inhibition to abolishing slavery, that one could do it right away. And he also pointed out that if we would live up to the words in the preamble of the Constitution, that our country would be a fine one.
And you point out in your book that Jefferson called slavery a sin against God, a quote-unquote fatal stain on Virginia. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Jefferson in his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, wrote, as you point out, that there would be a day of reckoning about slavery. How do you explain the contradiction between their ideals and some of their actual practices being slave owners?
Well, they all condemned slavery. They all saw it as immoral. But none of them could figure a way to achieve total emancipation, which is what justice demanded. They couldn't figure a way out. And so they went ahead and built a nation on great ideals. They built a nation, as a friend of mine once said, it was for a society better than their own. It allowed the country to develop in ways that were hostile to slavery, and it finally abolished slavery. The ideals, of course, are not fully realized yet, but the amazing progress we have made is, I think, unparalleled in the world.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about monuments and landmarks that have been erected to honor these men, especially Washington and Jefferson, being under attack, vandalized, even in some cases removed, because they're seen as honoring men who were slave owners and worse in the eyes of some?
Well, it's a simplistic way of looking at them, to think of them only as slaveholders. It's also crucially important to remember that they gave us the ideas on which this great country is based. The ideas, for example, that one can protest against what one perceives as injustice. It just strikes me that the people in the streets so often are condemning the nation lock, stock, and barrel without understanding how these important ideals have affected their lives, have affected everyone's life.
Well, one of the things that, as I read through your book, that I'm struck at with is your eye for the telling detail, whether it's Dolly Madison and her remarkable personality and all she brought to the marriage with James Madison. You also have a comment in your book about the inauguration of James Monroe and the crowd of like 8,000 people who had turned out to hear him on that sunny day in March of 1817, and you write, quote, "Since hardly anyone could hear Monroe's inaugural address, a marshal waved a white flag in a circle to show the crowd when to cheer." You just imagine that scene.
I thought that was a good detail. And there are other stories, you know, that are very personal, but they show the interrelationships of these men. Madison had his heart broken by a 15-year-old. Now, a 15-year-old was considered quite marriageable in the 18th century. But in any case, he thought everything was going along fine. Jefferson decided to take a hand in it and went to the young woman and told her what a great catch Madison was. But within weeks, she jilted him and forsook him for another man. He was heartbroken. And there's only part of a letter that he wrote to Jefferson, because late in his life, he scribbled it out as hard as he could, most of it. But you can see his misery. And Jefferson offered him advice. He said, the best thing to do is to take on unremitting occupation. In other words, get out and work and turn to things besides your own sorrows. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was personal advice. Jefferson also helped Monroe when Monroe thought he was going to be a really poor man forever. He had been counting on an inheritance, and that inheritance would be from a man much his senior. I think he was probably in his mid-50s when this happened. Sadly, for Monroe, the man got married and had a baby, a boy. So this meant that Monroe's hope for his uncle's fortune was certainly dimmed his prospects. So Jefferson took him under his wing and comforted Monroe at a time when, he was in deep sadness as well. So I love these personal details, too, the ones that show these men interacting.
And one of the things that I was struck as I read through your book were the serious financial difficulties that Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe all had, especially after they left the White House. Even during the presidency, you mentioned that, you know, at that time the salary was $25,000, but, like, they had to pay for entertainment. They had to pay for these national tours they went on. It came out of their own pocket back then.
And Monroe felt that he had not been properly reimbursed by the Congress for expenses that it seemed to him quite obvious they should have paid. The thousands of dollars he spent on lodging when he was sent to Europe, for example, to represent the United States. So he spent much of his retirement trying to recover what he believed was owed him from the Congress, and he succeeded. It wasn't enough money to, you know, set him up in palatial style, but it was enough to pay off his debts, let him finish the home he was building. And he died poor. He was forced to move in with his children up in New York. But he managed at least not to die in huge debt, which both Madison and Jefferson did.
And speaking of these personal relationships these men had with each other, Monroe as president, for instance, certainly had his hands full trying to keep General Andrew Jackson in line. I really enjoyed reading in your book about how he consulted with former President Madison for advice on how do I handle this guy?
Jackson was a terrible employee in a way.
Yes.
You know, he just didn't pay attention to instructions. He just went ahead and did his own thing and then was lionized for it, which made him ever harder to deal with. So it was good to have someone like Madison whose experience you could perhaps build on.
Well, and then it also, you know, firmed up a key element of the U.S. Constitution that the president as commander-in-chief, you know, and civilian control of the military, and Jackson had to be reminded about that a few times.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, exactly right. And in fact, Madison at the Constitutional Convention had a large responsibility in making the president commander-in-chief during the war. As the clause in the Constitution was originally considered, you could have read it so that Congress would be in charge of war. And it's hard to imagine Congress being able to manage war. Such a complicated business and so many people. So Madison not only modeled the idea of the chief executive being a civilian and commander-in-chief, but he had helped originate it.
And you do a nice job, I think, too, of explaining this whole declaration of war situation involving the War of 1812 and the steps that Madison took to get to that point. It was the first time, of course, in the young American nation that the country had officially declared war against anyone, and there were a lot of precedents being set.
Yes, he was very careful to lead the Congress to declare war, to persuade the Congress to declare war, but he didn't do it himself. And as you say, that put meat on the bones of the constitutional theory.
What were a couple of the, say, most surprising facts, information about these men of the Virginia dynasty that you uncovered during your research?
Well, Monroe's terrible temper. his papers are almost out now in full. And for years, scholars have had to depend upon a partial selection of them. And in the new edition, you can see how much Monroe relieved his tensions and his anger by writing the nastiest memos and letters that you can possibly imagine. One to Washington is especially notable. But then he didn't send them. It's very interesting. I mean, I can see that being a good mechanism for letting off anger. The point that puzzles me, or the question that this raises, is did he mean to keep them? Did he want us to read later how angry he had been with Washington? I don't think so. I think it's an accident, really, that they're included. But, you know, that's very interesting to see that side of Monroe.
And not only Monroe, but Jefferson also had a falling out with Washington. You point out in your book as well that he said nothing publicly or apparently even privately about Washington's death. And he did visit Martha Washington at Mount Vernon shortly after Washington's death. And you point out in your book that a friend recalled her saying this of his visit, quote, "Next to the loss of her husband, it was the most painful experience of her life."
The schism between Washington on the one hand and the other three, Madison, Jefferson, and Monroe, was deep and painful. Monroe, for example, not only wrote these private blasting memos, he also wrote some very critical ones that were public. And Washington never quite forgave, well, he never forgave Madison and Washington for believing that a political opposition was not only justified but necessary in a republic. Washington had the idea that the voters ought to elect the president, for example, and then leave him alone and let him govern rather than carping away at what they perceived to be his failings. The younger generation knew that this was not a way in which the country could function.
We're just about out of time, Dr. Cheney, but I did want to ask you a couple of other quick questions. First, how long did you spend researching your book?
Well, researching and writing to me are all the same thing, but it was a very long time, well over 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And you have an extensive bibliography, goes more than 20 pages. Any particular sources you found especially helpful as you put your book together?
Well, the documents, the primary documents, the papers of Washington, Jefferson, and Madison are online. Isn't that an amazing thing?
It's incredible.
So you can go read what it was that was troubling Madison at the Constitutional Convention. You can go online and read Jefferson's fury when Monroe refused to appoint someone that Jefferson recommended to office. So those primary documents are the whole thing. And modern scholarship is very much, I was going to say totally, but it's almost totally in debt to the editors of those documents.
Do you have another book or other writing projects in the foreseeable future coming up?
I'm going to think about it. You know, after 5.5 years, probably I need to take a break.
Okay. It sounds like well-deserved.
Well, thank you.
Really enjoyed the book. This put a lot of personal touches for these four men as I read through them. By the time I got to the end of the book, I felt like I knew each one of them better through their correspondence with each other and the various events and situations you lay out so well in your book. So we really want to thank you for joining us today. We enjoyed visiting with you, Dr. Cheney.
Well, it's a privilege, and I appreciate all your good questions. So you're a good interviewer, a great interviewer. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank my guest today, Dr. Lynn Cheney. She's written a timely and fascinating new book, The Virginia Dynasty, Four Presidents and the Creation of the American Nation, published by Viking Press. And thanks to all of you Prairie Public Radio listeners for joining us today.
That was historian Dr. Lynn Cheney talking about the book The Virginia Dynasty, Four Presidents and the Creation of the American Nation, visiting with Rick Collin, a former instructor at the University of Mary and a presidential historian. Still to come on Main Street, we visit with a documentary filmmaker exploring ways to restore the planet. But now, it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A peacetime emergency declared by Minnesota DFL Governor Tim Walz has been extended again after debate and a vote during a fifth special legislative session. The Republican-controlled Senate voted to end the emergency. The DFL-controlled House did not. Republican Representative Ann New said the order allowing the governor to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic is no longer needed.
There's not been a single executive order in the last month. In fact, the last executive order made regarding COVID was made in August.
Minnesota Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm says the growth in COVID-19 infections shows the health danger still exists.
Concern heading deeper into the fall at such a high level of case growth just again underscores the need for nimbleness and speed.
The peacetime emergency will be in effect for another 30 days. Midwest Ag Energy has begun drilling a carbon dioxide capture well at the site of the plant near Washburn. Midwest Blue Flint Ethanol Plant uses steam from the nearby Coal Creek Station power plant in its ethanol production. CO2 is also a byproduct of ethanol production. Midwest CEO Jeff Zuger says preliminary testing shows promise for carbon capture.
The 3D seismic data and existing kind of well data that exists in the area have been very supportive. And the 3D seismic data is probably the strongest data we have, but it's not enough to move ahead with the Class 6 permit. So we need the data that we'll get from these core samples and the subsequent reservoir modeling to tell us definitively we can do this and that the North Dakota Industrial Commission can get comfortable giving us a permit to do it.
The Industrial Commission approved a proposal by the Lignite Research Council to spend $3 million in this test. Jason Bohr of the Lignite Energy Council.
My message from the coal industry on this project is pretty simple. If you start putting CO2 in a hole in the ground, it's a huge deal for the future of coal.
Zuger says the plan is to store 200,000 tons of CO2 underground each year. And parts of North Dakota could see some rain and strong winds by Wednesday.
We have a really powerful system coming at us here late tonight into Wednesday.
Bismarck National Weather Service meteorologist Michael Holland.
It's looking like maybe a few tenths of an inch of rain across the northern half of the state. Now there might be some snow that mixes in with that during the early morning hours on Wednesday, but no accumulation is expected with that, and that snow would mainly be along and north of Highway 2.
Holland says the bigger threat from this system is strong wind.
Could see sustained winds anywhere from 25 to 35 miles per hour, gusts anywhere from 45 to even possibly a size 55 miles per hour in southwest and south central parts of the state.
Holland says the wind should start to pick up early Wednesday morning.
Be a very difficult traveling conditions for high-profile vehicles, and of course any loose objects will be easily blown around.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Benedictine Living Center of Garrison, providing long-term skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, outpatient therapy, and assisted and independent living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcgarrison.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is filmmaker Amy Young. She is one of the directors of The Age of Nature, a new PBS series that travels the world to explore innovative ways that people are restoring our planet, and it premieres tomorrow night on Prairie Public. Amy joins us via Zoom from England. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ashley.
I want to talk about the title, The Age of Nature. Nature's been here all along. Why are we calling it that?
Well, I think for quite a few generations now, we've been taking nature for granted and we haven't really felt part of it. And I think what this series hopes to show is that there are people around the world where we are working with nature like we haven't for quite a few generations. And, you know, this could be the start of us helping to restore our planet. And we pose the question, could we be entering an era of history, of human history, which is the age of nature, where we work with nature and we help to end the climate crisis and global warming. And the best way of doing that is by entering the age of nature and working with nature. at any time during the filming of this series, because I was able to watch the episode that's very U.S. focused, although it does go across the world within that episode. But there is just story after story after story of nature was here and had a system, and then humans came in, thought they had a better idea, and then it turns out that, you know, maybe it wasn't such a great idea. So I'm just wondering, like, during the entire process, if you could distill one thing that you would want to say to fellow humans, what would it be?
I think it would be not to fear animals. I think we, you know, we've exterminated animals that we are fearful of and we don't like because we feel they're in competition with us. So in particular in episode 2, which I produced, is the Yellowstone story. And, yes. And what I really loved about that story was how, you know, we've exterminated these animals, and then Yellowstone National Park, you know, works so hard to bring them back. And that was to help save an endangered species, that one individual species, the wolf. But what they discovered through doing that was that how key that species is in the whole ecosystem, and how just their presence helps balance nature again. And, you know, areas weren't overgrazed anymore and were able to grow back. And I think it started that realization that we need all animals. We can't pick and choose which animals we like and which animals we don't like. You know, we need them all because we need it all in balance. And that's when it works, and that's when it can help us.
The Yellowstone story, the wolf story, especially as you are into a Western United States, where there is lots of ranching and people who are working the land and providing some of the animals and sometimes crops that people, of course, are using as their own food supply. It's a very delicate balance when you talk about an animal like a wolf, a very skilled predator. How did you find the ranchers that you wanted to talk to about how they exist or how a wolf population might threaten their livelihood?
Yeah, and that was another aspect of the Yellowstone story that we wanted to get across, because these ranchers are now having to ranch alongside these wolves. And, you know, there is no doubt about it. Some of them will go after their cattle or hassle their cattle. But, you know, what's fantastic and what the ranchers are able to do is you know, manage those wolf populations. So if one is hassling their cattle, they are allowed to shoot it. And I think it's important that they are given that option, because what wolves, you know, if they decide that they quite like hunting cattle, then it's very difficult to persuade that wolf not to. And so, you know, as a biologist, I wouldn't, you know, want to shoot any animal. But for the ranchers, you know, it's important that they take out an individual like that so that they don't teach their offspring to hunt cattle as well. So by removing the individual who is hunting cattle, you are removing that behavior from the population. So not only is it giving, you know, these ranchers short-term control, it is also hopefully going to help more long-term the wolves living alongside ranching. And it does appear that there is an openness to the wolves returning. I think the ranchers generally, it feels like they've got their heads around the fact that they are, you know, ranching alongside wolves. Some of them would rather not be, but they are accepting that the wolves are part of the landscape now and that they need to make it work. And I think, you know, the fact that they are allowed to you know, intervene when a wolf is hassling their cattle, that is important for them. Otherwise, I think they would struggle much more.
Also within that Yellowstone episode, and you mentioned this already, is that introducing wolves back to an area can impact the actual vegetation. And I didn't really think about that, but of course, if something like the deer or elk population gets a little comfortable, I do the same thing. I put on my yoga pants and I'm extra comfortable and I just eat more than I really need to. But also, I was surprised to learn that there was a researcher, a scientist featured in the show, who talks about how the wolves are making the prey animals stronger and smarter. Can you describe how that part works?
Yeah, so, because these wolves are predators who go for sick or injured animals, you know, they will spot who the weaker individuals are in a herd, and they will go after that animal because it's easier for them to catch and kill it. And so just by doing that, they are making the population of elk or bison or deer, you know, healthier and stronger, because those weaker individuals or those sick individuals are being weeded out. So it's you know, it's amazing how nature works. It's kind of got it right. But you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, sometimes we fiddle with these things because we believe we know better. But actually, nature is a finely tuned system, and you know, the presence of predators does actually help keep their prey populations healthy.
Sure. Well, sometimes that fiddling is for an economic reason. Part of the series takes us to South Africa and to the Fynbos ecosystem, which is very important for the water supply for the Western Cape of South Africa, including Cape Town. And there were pine trees that were introduced, and this was so that we could be harvesting more lumber, of course, a very important industry. What happens when, because it sounds like planting a tree is a good thing, right?
Mm.
But we have to look at the area and the types of trees that are being planted, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the key here is that the pine species and the eucalyptus species that were planted evolved in much wetter climates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and they are trees that drink a lot of water. So eucalyptus are found in Australia, which obviously isn't known for its rain, but they always live alongside rivers. And then the pine trees, obviously famously from Scotland, they're used to a much wetter ecosystem. So you put them into a dry ecosystem and they're going to suck whatever water they possibly can out. And they were taking a lot of the water from the watersheds that was supplying Cape Town with water. And then you add into that, you know, sort of more drought. And that's why the situation in Cape Town reached such a climax. And, you know, facing having to turn off the water supply for the city, which, mm-hmm. you think it's rare, but then the more you look into it, the more cities around the world are facing these kind of water crises. And I think the importance is that those watershed areas are full of native species that are finely balanced. That Fynbos has spent millions of years evolving to not having a lot of water, but utilizing the fog that rolls in off the sea, the unique position that it's got in the Western Cape. And so it doesn't actually use a lot of that water that's found in the groundwater and in these watershed areas, and then they call their reservoirs dams. So in those sort of large dams which supply the city with water. And they don't use a lot of that water because they're used to not having a lot of rainwater. Yeah. But you add in those pine trees, and it just completely knocks the whole system out of balance. So trees aren't always good, and that was the point we were trying to make. Native trees in their native country are brilliant, but you know, you can't just go and plant any species anywhere.
Yeah, I'm thinking a few years back, there was, I think it was a cereal company that was including a package of seeds with every purchase of cereal so that you could be planting to help the monarch population. But then, of course, it was, you know, plants that grow where I'm at in North Dakota wouldn't be a good idea in South Carolina or vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, all these initiatives are great, but you just have to check that you're planting a native species in its rightful place. So, you know, planting trees is brilliant and it's going to be amazing for climate change, but you can't just plant them anywhere. You've got to plant them where there used to be forests,
you know, where they're suited to, and these native species in the right place.
So does the series at all explore the idea of what if what we're doing now, 40 years, 100 years, 200 years, turns out to be, you know, the, you know, 200 years from now, a different Amy Young filmmaker is saying how we have to reverse what we're doing now? How are we making sure we're not just making a different mistake?
That's a really interesting point. And I think, you know, we've got to the point in our understanding, our scientific understanding, that, you know, ecosystems are really, really so much better understood now. And that was the point we were trying to make in this episode, was that, you know, the scientists have done all this research. They know how these ecosystems work. And, you know, they understand nature. And I think you can't go wrong when you work with nature. And I would bet a lot of money that this is the right way. And we're not going to get to 50, 100 years down the line and go, oh, whoops, we made a mistake. You know, I really think that working with nature, we actually can't go wrong with that.
I see this theme emerging in a number of interviews that I have been doing. So from yours, you're talking about looking at an entire ecosystem. When I talk with educators, we're talking about looking at a whole child perspective and not just, you know, visual learners or what have you. And in the world of medicine, we're doing integrative care. But I think they can all be summed up with the word holistic.
Mm.
So if you could talk just about the importance of the point of view of coming at something holistically. In the episode that I saw, there is a dam that is built for hydroelectric power, and it seems like a good idea. We should be using a natural resource like water for power, but then of course it blocks off a majorly important food source for both the people of that area and for the wildlife of that area.
Yeah, so, you know, that was another really interesting story. And I think, you know, as you, exactly as you say, hydropower is something that is a great way for us to make energy. But crucially, that ecosystem wasn't understood, and the species that lived there wasn't understood when those dams were put in. So there were no fish ladders, which are basically a way of the fish being able to still get upriver. So when those dams were put in place, there was no way for the fish to get upriver to spawn. And the habitat that was available to them to spawn was not only much, much smaller, but also not as ideal for them and their spawning. So they might spawn, but the eggs actually wouldn't actually ever hatch. So the population massively crashed of these particular salmon called Chinook salmon. And I think now we understand that if we are going to put hydroelectric dams in, we have to make sure that species like that can get upriver to spawn. So it's just working out ways where we can do what we do, but we don't impact nature so much, you know. And in episode one, which goes out tomorrow night on PBS, we feature the Panama Canal, and there it was realized that you really did need nature. So this is an amazing feat of human engineering where, you know, ships can go, instead of having to go all the way around South America, they can literally nip across Panama through the Panama Canal and they pop out the other side. And it saves weeks and weeks of travel. It saves lots of carbon and fuel. You know, it's fantastic in so many ways. But crucially, that canal needs the forests that line it. So it's surrounded by this amazing forests. But this wasn't realized when it was built. And these forests started being cut down because it wasn't understood that the forests not only hold on to water when during the rainy season when there's a lot of rain and they stop flooding, but they also hold on to water in the dry season and they can release that water back into the river and keep those boats flowing. So, you know, we can benefit hugely from nature when we understand how it works. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that we try and get across in the series.
A few people have looked at the pandemic that we are in
as having the silver lining of cutting down on air traffic, which is a major contributor to climate change. I'm just wondering, I know this is not the scope of the program that we are talking about today, of course, but I'm just wondering, as someone who has been in this line of work for a long time, how you view a time like this and the possible impacts on our climate.
Yeah, you know, again, working in this industry for over 20 years, you know, we've always wrestled with the fact that we have to fly to different locations in order to do our filming. And certainly something that we did on this production, we have offset all our carbon from our flights, from our hire cars, you know, anything that was using carbon, we kept note of, and we've offset that carbon by investing in, you know, green energy projects and blue carbon projects. Which you learn about in episode 3. And, you know, I think it's difficult. You can't tell people that they can't fly. But I think what we have realised, as you say, through the pandemic, is that, you know, we need to just maybe pare it back a little bit, be a little bit more mindful and a bit more aware when we do fly or we do all these things that contribute to climate change, that we either try and offset that in some way. And in episode 3, we look at how in Indonesia, in Borneo, there's a green carbon project where you can invest in these companies that buy areas of pristine rainforest and keep it pristine. And this could be a new way for people to offset carbon. And there somehow you're getting some kind of balance where we're still managing to live in the modern world, but we are also being quite mindful of nature and the natural world.
I've always been curious about nature documentaries, and they have this amazing ability to get names like Sir Attenborough, and we have Oprah Winfrey, or in this case, it's narrated by Uma Thurman. And I'm just wondering, like, what is the process of working with these people?
So sometimes, you know, we will get a name on board initially, but what often happens is that you approach people once you've made it and you can show them what you've made. Mm. And if it's something that they feel strongly about and enjoy and want to be involved in, then they will come on board and they will narrate the series. But if someone is appearing in vision, you would get that person involved much earlier in the process. So there's kind of different ways of doing it. But in this case, Uma, you know, really, really was passionate about what we were saying and how we were saying it. So she came on towards the end of production to narrate the series for us.
The Age of a Nature premieres tomorrow night on Prairie Public. We're visiting with filmmaker Amy Young. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
That's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by BNC National Bank, dedicated to providing financial solutions for businesses and consumers throughout the region. More information online at bncbank.com.
It's election season, and parents, do we have an important debate for you? Hi, I'm Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. Please join my colleague Matt Olean and I for another in a series of candidate debates throughout the month of October. One with particular interest is for the race of North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction between Kirsten Baszler and Brant Dick. That's happening Friday, October 16th at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain. You can count on Prairie Public to get you closer to the candidates whose policies could majorly impact your family.
Prairie Public Live Debate Coverage 2020 is sponsored in part by AARP North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 13th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
In 1914, suffragists increasingly campaigned for the right to vote as the election on the matter approached. Speakers of some renown came to North Dakota, including Mrs. Antoinette Funk, a suffrage leader from Illinois. It was a visit that led to her arrest. The reason? She was speaking in the street without a permit. Minot had a strict ordinance about this, passed following an incident in 1913 when industrial workers of the world sent men to Minot, which led to agitation and riots.
Many men were arrested or fined to get them off the street, including Arthur LeSueur, former mayor and an attorney of the city, who ended up representing the men in court. Fast forward to 1914. Mrs. Funk began speaking about suffrage from an automobile in front of the post office as a large crowd gathered. A police officer told her it was against the law to speak on the streets and obstruct traffic. She asked him to explain this rule, which he couldn't do, so she tried to find a copy of the ordinance. She was told the ordinance had been published in the newspaper, which made it legal, but unable to look at a copy, she was determined to finish her speech. She said but few words before getting arrested. Other reports said she had applied for a permit, but failed to get one, which seems unlikely if she didn't know about the city's law. A newspaper in Washington, D.C. attributed the arrest to disorderly conduct. A hearing was scheduled immediately, and the police court was packed with both men and women, suffragists and others. Mrs. Funk was represented by LeSueur, who asserted she was not at fault, that she had tried to look up the law, and that she was a woman of high social standing and character. Nonetheless, she was found guilty and fined $5. The judge stated, "There can be no question. You knew you were violating the city ordinance. I think you are earnest enough in your efforts, but justice must be done." However, with her fine later remitted and the charge dropped, Mrs. Funk's visit through the state was touted as a success. This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
Millions of people across this country are struggling to collect unemployment benefits.
It's so hard to just prove that you exist.
Fraudulent claims made during the pandemic have led to a tougher review process and long delays to people getting paid. But are the added security measures even working?
Sadly, they haven't been protecting the system from much fraud.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, data for good, can it be helpful in tracking the pandemic? Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner host the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, and they visit with Dr. Farzad Mostashari, who chairs the COVID-19 Data Challenge. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.